listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another Catch Them Doing Something Good edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Every Monday from 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time to noon, my guests and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. My co-host today is Linda McKinney. Linda has worked in the mental health field and recovery industry for over 20 years. She is currently the founder of ASNAP, which is Adolescent Special Needs and Placement, and also known as the queen of her domain and everything in it. Linda, welcome to the show.
Always. You always have to throw that one in, and I appreciate it. Thank you for having me here,
Alan. Yeah. For anybody that knows you, they would know if I didn't, I would be remiss.
You would be corrected.
That's right. Now, our guest today is Dr. Kara Natterson. Kara has treated thousands of children in private practice and is the author of three books: Your Newborn Head to Toe, Your Toddler Head to Toe, and Dangerous or Safe. She has appeared as a pediatric and parenting expert on television shows such as Today and CNN, and has contributed to Cookie Magazine, MomLogic.com, ParentsAsk.com, and GuruMommy.com. A graduate of Harvard College and Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Dr. Natterson is a board-certified pediatrician and a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She lives in California with her husband and two children. Kara's forthcoming book, Dangerous or Safe, helps parents understand what foods, drinks, medicines, and devices are truly dangerous for kids, and which are simply victims of hype. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. I had a chance to read through part of the book, and again, it's called Dangerous or Safe. And in reading it, it gets a little scary for the things that I know that we're already giving our kids. And the first thing that caught my eye was cell phones.
You picked the scariest chapter, didn't you?
Yes.
But of course.
Yes. Well, it was the scariest for me, knowing that, I mean, not only do I have one, and people have accused the fact that it's surgically attached, but my children have one. And at this point, I mean, it seems that most anybody has one. So before I go through any of the questions that are geared towards helping anybody else, I'm going to be very selfish and ask, for somebody who wears an earpiece. Okay, so the earpiece is near my head, but the phone is attached to my hip. Now, where am I potentially in danger? And, you know, not that I ever intend to have children again, I really don't want a cell phone to make that decision.
Well, let me start by saying that in the book, there are 25 chapters, and cell phones is really the only alarmist chapter. Everything else is pretty safe for you in moderation, but cell phones are the one thing I do worry about. And you're doing it right by using a wired earpiece, because you're removing the antenna from being right next to your head. Our concern about cell phones is that when you hold them up to your head, you have that antenna pressed right against your skull, and there is electromagnetic radiation that comes in and out of that antenna, and we don't know what the consequences of that radiation exposure will be in the future. This is no different from your cordless phone at home. The mechanism is the exact same. So you should be using wires. That means corded phones at home and plugging in that wired earpiece. Now, you ask about putting the actual cell phone by your hip. And if it's in a holster, actually those holsters do provide a little bit of protection. And if the antenna is pointed away from your body, you're probably doing okay. Women do a little better than men, I find, because they tend to hold their phones either in their hand or in their purse. And that is a couple of inches away from their body at least. So they are separating themselves farther from the electromagnetic field. And that couple of inches makes a big difference.
I just need to ask you, where did you compile this data Where did you get this information?
You know, there are hundreds of studies that are published in through the medical literature and that are all gathered on Medline and other medical research databases. So it's all published peer-reviewed studies that I've looked at. The cell phone data, there's a lot more data in Europe than there is that comes out of the U.S., although the U.S. is catching up. And when the book was published, there was right around the time the book was first published, which was last year, there was a big incident out of the University of Pittsburgh where the head of their outpatient oncology center said, I've read this data, and I don't want to see my staff holding cell phones up to their head. I treat patients with tumors all day long, and I'm just nervous that there is a possibility that there could be a real connection. Everyone says, I don't know. And that's the real answer, is we don't know. But it's an easy fix to put a wire in between your ear and your device. So that's just a very, very, very simple mechanism to make it a little bit safer.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Well, and I think with some of the laws now taking us into hands-free, so now you have people, you know, it's the law. If you're going to be driving in the car, it needs to be hands-free,
which
I think more people are now going to have, you know, have the earpieces and such. So
That's right. It's ironic that law will protect people against the tiny risk maybe of more cancer. It does not protect against the risk of accidental injury while you're driving. The data shows that you're just as likely to get in an accident if you're talking hands-free and if you're talking holding the phone.
Oh, didn't know that one.
Yep. So you should really not be talking on that phone if you can help it while you're driving. It's much safer to be talking to someone in the car or to listen to the radio, actually.
Okay. I guess then it's probably not a good idea to save up messages like I do when I'm in the office, because I know I have to go on a one-hour drive, and I'll wait to do that so that I can call them back from the car.
Exactly. I think we all do that, and we multitask from our cars, but it's probably not the best solution.
Okay. Well, and I know that in reading the book, I mean, the majority of the things that we're talking about was more from the standpoint of foods and medicines and chemicals and things that are in our kids. I just know that as I was reading it, the cell phone thing struck me personally. But what do you foresee as being the biggest health risk that children are going to face now or this next fall?
Well, you know, flu season came last fall with a bang because we had H1N1, and every year we face influenza in our communities. But we don't know if our flu season is sort of petering off or if we are getting ready for the second big hit with H1N1. And no one knows, and no one quite knows how to predict. I still think we're in the throes of flu season, and we need to be thinking about all that common sense preventive care, hand washing, the most important thing that you can do to keep yourself healthy.
Okay, well, that brings us right to the concept of vaccines. I mean, where do you stand on that? Is it something that we should do? Is it something that, I mean, you have two children. Is it something that you're giving your kids?
Yeah, I do have two children, 4.5 and 6.5, and they are both fully vaccinated. I have read every study published on vaccines, both for my own patients and my own children, and the data is very overwhelming that vaccines are safe and that the diseases that these vaccines prevent against are what we need to worry about. We need to worry about the diseases that we take for granted now because we haven't seen them for 20 or 30 or 40 years, and if we don't continue to vaccinate, they will be back. An amazing thing happened in the world of vaccines last week. There was an article that was published in 1998 that started this sort of skepticism about vaccines movement, and that article was published in a journal called The Lancet, and it was about the MMR vaccine. And last week, The Lancet formally retracted the article and said, you know what? We never should have published it. The data was not good data. And that is an incredible thing, because when you think about the past 12 years and the passion with which the vaccine opponents have fought vaccines, to think that it really stemmed from this original article that is now being formally retracted is a very, very big deal in medicine.
Wow.
That's really something. I have a question for you. My daughters are older now, but I breastfed my youngest daughter for a while, and I was under the assumption that she would get all my immunities through breast milk. And that's all she had. And she, there was no supplemental bottles or anything like that. But yet she contacted, was exposed to and contacted chickenpox. Which, of course, as a baby was miserable. But still, I was really surprised that she did get the chickenpox, because is that a false assumption that if I was vaccinated against it through my breast milk, she wouldn't have gotten it?
No, you made the right assumption. When babies get breast milk, they get what's called passive antibody. They get their mother's antibodies against a whole variety of infections. And they get that also when they're in the womb. The mother's antibody goes through the placenta and actually stays in a newborn baby's body for several weeks after birth. But that's passive antibody. It's not active antibody. And the difference is that active antibody is antibody that a baby can produce on their own to fight, to mount a response against an infection. That type of antibody is different than the passive antibody that babies get from their mother's breast milk. So passive antibody is very good and very helpful. But as you saw in your own family, it doesn't work 100% of the time. And it is really active antibody that we want. Active antibody is stimulated by some of the vaccines that young babies get. But as I'm sure you know, the chickenpox vaccine is an example of a vaccine you can't even get until you're a year old. It doesn't even work until you're a year old. So unfortunately, right. babies under the age of one, when they get exposed to chickenpox, tend to have what your daughter had, which is just a nasty case of chickenpox.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And I think everybody knows right now, and one of the biggest topics in the news is our current health care, the health care fight, or so it appears. Now, what do you feel about our current health care crisis? And in your opinion, does there need to be a complete overhaul of the current system? You know, do we need a public option, or can reform happen without it?
You know, it worries me to think that we might not continue moving through this process of review. We desperately need health insurance reform in this country. The reality is that millions and millions of people cannot afford insurance and therefore don't get to the doctor in time and end up getting very, very sick and costing the system much more money. I myself have seen many children come to the emergency room for very routine, even preventive care things that they could have done at a doctor's office, but they don't have access to the doctor. So this is a terrible state of affairs. The problem from a doctor's standpoint is that the insurance companies, unfortunately, continue to profit even in the some of the proposed reforms. And so where we're getting cuts is at the hospital level, and doctors are getting cut, and patients are finding that they're getting charged more. But the one place that really needs some trimming, which is at the level of the insurance company, it's not happening. And so my doctor friends and I are quite concerned that if that is passed, it actually won't provide any relief in the system at all, because all we're going to have is 40 million new customers who are paying insurance companies, and the insurance companies aren't that accountable right now. So we need some insurance reform here. We need our insurance companies to be a part of the solution and not part of the problem.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, does it seem like all we're really doing is adding another layer of bureaucracy? I mean, you know, so now we have the government and the insurance companies to worry about?
Yes, I think so. I think, you know, the right step would be to say to the insurance companies, you need to be partners in health care and help people find affordable care and stop skimming profits off the top, because that will release a level of the bureaucracy. It doesn't solve a lot of the problems, right? It doesn't solve the problem that just like when you call your insurance company and you get put on hold for 20 minutes, when I call the insurance company on your behalf, I get put on hold too. And when I finally get through, I might be speaking to someone that has no medical training. That piece isn't solved by any of this legislation. But the goal is to at least cover more people so that, you know, we don't have 45 million uninsured Americans who, instead of going to the doctor with their sore throat, when they're afraid they can't pay for it, they end up in the hospital with something much more serious down the road because they didn't take the little step early on. And that's really what we need to say. We need more preventive care and more early care so that the that people aren't wiped out when they don't attend to their own health.
Mm-hmm. Now, it sounds like you feel that healthcare is a human right. What can we also do, or how much of that do you think is also our individual responsibility, and what can we do?
Yeah, I think it's 50-50. I think we have the right to health care in this country, and I think we have the responsibility to pay for our own health care. One of the biggest problems in my mind is that when we all get our paychecks from our employers, our health insurance is paid off the top. And so when I ask people, how much do you pay for your health care, they often don't know. Mm-hmm. And by not participating in our own health care, not understanding where our dollars are going, it's very hard to feel responsibility for this piece of legislation, and most Americans separate themselves. So maybe a simple solution is to say to people, look, it'll still come off the top, but there's going to be a highlighted line on your paycheck that shows exactly how much you paid for your health insurance. Let people start seeing how many dollars they're putting into this system so that they can start wanting to participate in the reform.
Now, how many people like you are involved in these discussions? In other words, if we just have government and insurance company having this discussion, who do we have like yourself that's involved in helping them see this side of it?
Right. Well, this is the worst part. The worst part is that physicians, particularly primary care physicians like pediatricians and internists and family practitioners, we are so overwhelmed with the volume of patients that we need to see that we don't really have a lot of time to go on the front lines. So there are some lobbying organizations that represent some doctors, but the reality is that I don't think doctor voices are heard very much in this debate because we're busy taking care of the patients. And it's unfortunate, but where there is only so much to go around, and if we have choice between making someone healthy and lobbying on our own behalf, we tend to choose making someone healthy. Unfortunately, that's probably not the smartest thing for us as a group of professionals. It's still, you know, it's what we do. It's what we do for a living, and so we haven't been very good about organizing our voice. But there are some good lobbying organizations that are trying to share the physician's voice. Really, the problem is sort of the fact that the insurance reform that needs to go on just hasn't happened because they are much better organized in terms of they're protecting their own business interest.
Correct, and their agenda. And I think you touched on a great point. I mean, if we go on the basis, you know, and I believe this, I mean, the majority of people that choose your profession is because they care about people, and that's what they see themselves doing, not worrying about fighting about all these other problems and things. And there's even some things in the business world. I mean, I'm also an investigator, and in the investigative world, one of the axioms is that doctors get embezzled from more than most because of the fact that they're so focused on their patients, they're not focused on the money.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so I can see that, but at the same time, I think that this is happening almost across the board because a lot of professions now, a lot of us are all, you know, I just came back from a conference and it was a group of people who are also trying to help people. They're trying to help kids, and it's helping kids in specialized programs and such. And the overwhelming discussion was, we're working twice as hard to make half the money, and we don't have time to fight some of these battles. And that now I hear you saying the same thing, and it's really a shame if you have all of the people that care that much about people are not involved in the discussion, because that's who needs to be involved in discussion.
Well, that's exactly right. I think you've said it very articulately, and you know, I think we are starting to see physician voices emerge, but certainly, you know, the bill that is on the table, none of us understand. I mean, I certainly haven't read all 2,000 pages, and there are two bills now, so none of us really understand it, and I don't think our voice is very well represented in this incarnation. So we shall see what emerges in the next few weeks, and hopefully if this goes through another round, there will be more physician voices heard, because I think it will be very important in terms of the long-term health and well-being of people in this country.
You know, this is unfortunate, but you're probably going to let me know it's true. If a person is sent their bills, normal bills, gas, electric, whatever, doctor bills are usually the last ones to be paid, and that's because people are under the assumption, well, doctors make all this money, they certainly don't need mine. And it seems to be that I've heard this from lots of doctors that I've worked with, that they're the last ones to get paid.
Yeah, that, I think that is part of it. The other part is, have you ever tried to read one of your explanation of benefits bills? I mean, it's impossible,
it is.
Right?
It is.
It's really difficult. And so it becomes very confusing for the consumer to understand even what they need to pay. There's a line on there. I always bring this up when people want to understand how medical payments work. There's a line that says patient savings, and it's a very confusing. You think, oh, this is what they have paid the doctor, that I don't need to pay the doctor. No, that is what the insurance company has decided they're not going to pay, and you don't have to pay either. And no one needs to pay that amount of money. But they put it in the biggest, boldest area on the bill, and it gets very confusing, because when you ask patients, well, what do you think your doctor made, they don't realize that the doctor, you know, a very typical pediatric charge for a checkup visit, you know, we do all this preventive care. We want to prevent obesity. We want to prevent illness. We want to prevent accidental injury and death. We're working hard, and we're getting paid $27 for all of that. And the patients look at the bill and say, no, you're not. You're getting paid this much. No, that's the bold line. Now look over three squares.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we got paid. And
right.
So it's very, I think it's intentionally confusing. And I think that also leads patients to believe that physicians are better reimbursed than they are. Listen, we're very lucky to have jobs. And I think many people have said over the past year and a half or 2 years that medicine seems to be a recession-proof industry, and none of us shake our head at that. We feel very, very fortunate to be employed in a time where this country is going through some very difficult transitions. I just worry that as our parents age, and as we age, and as our children become adults and they become parents, that we're setting up a system that's not going to be able to sustain itself, and that's not going to encourage really smart, hardworking people to go into medicine, and that worries me.
I certainly understand. Now, I'm glad you brought up the thing about the bill. In fact, I'm one of the ones that's guilty about that, because the insurance company sends their copy and the medical company sends theirs, and I've had situations where I've got, you know, people sending me money back saying that I paid too much, and then other ones sending me something saying, wait a minute, you owe this and you didn't pay it. And I said, but I got something from the insurance company that said I'm not supposed to, and they said, no, that's the wrong thing. You're right. It's very, very confusing. And I'm really glad that you explained that, because I thought I was the only one.
Oh, no. You can be really, really smart and not be able to read one of these bills.
No, the word contracted rate, or words contracted rate also.
Yes.
This is what you're contracted with, and the doctors are getting no more.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And I always remind people that, you know, someone's getting that money, and it's usually your insurance company. So we're thinking about, you know, how much money you're paying into your insurance and whether you're using that benefit. You know, think about medical savings plans. These are really great solutions for people who have, you know, young adults who have young children and everyone in the home is healthy. Well, a medical savings plan is a great way to think about using your tax-free dollars for healthcare, because you have a little bit more control and you understand where your money goes. And I think there are a lot more employers who are willing to include medical savings plans in the list of options for their employees.
Yeah, I think that makes good sense as well. Now, I want to go back to the book for a little bit, and I thank you for sharing with us some of the things in regards to our national health crisis. But I know also that, I mean, in regards to the book, there's some things on there, and if you could touch a little bit, because again, I went through the book, but it doesn't mean the listeners did. Touch on some of the things that people would not normally think either are dangerous, or people would not normally think something that we've thought is that really isn't. So dispel some of the myths for us.
Well, I think one great example is milk. Milk has earned a pretty bad reputation among certain communities where parents are very focused on health and nutrition of their children, which is a good thing, but they've decided that milk is not necessarily a healthy drink, and the data is actually totally opposite that. Milk is one of the most important things that your child can have. When I use the word milk, by the way, I mean not just cow's milk. I mean soy milk, almond milk, coconut milk, hemp milk. You can have any number of forms of milk, so that there are some children who are allergic to cow's milk or who are lactose intolerant or don't like it, and there are lots of alternatives. But milk in general provides a tremendous amount of protein. It provides great calcium, so bones can grow long and strong. And when you look at children, and especially teenagers, who drink milk compared to those who drink soda or juice, those milk drinkers tend to be a lot leaner. It's our soda and juice drinking kids who tend to be overweight or obese. So milk is the second most important drink that you can drink. Water is the most important, and those are pretty much the two drinks that you should have in your home.
I have a question about that, though, because I've heard conflicting answers here. First off, we're the only mammals that continue to drink milk after a certain length of time, of course. But to what age? Is there an age where milk is no longer really that good for you, or you're not getting the things out of milk, the good things out of milk that you need to get?
Well, calcium continues to be important, particularly for women, for their entire life. And we absorb calcium better through food and drink than we do when we just take a calcium supplement in the form of a pill. So there are studies that show that women who drink milk or eat calcium-containing foods, and those are, you know, green leafy vegetables, orange fruits, there are lots of foods that are very high in calcium, but women who have a diet that's high in calcium tend to have a slower progression to osteoporosis, which is a very big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You are right that there are a lot of folks that point out specifically that we are the only mammals that drink other mammals' milks for a prolonged period of time, which is why I'm very active about saying it doesn't have to be cow's milk. There's nothing magical about cow's milk per se. But, you know, coconut milk, for example, it has been a staple in many countries for centuries and is a very good source. Now, it's a source of and it's been very important to stave off malnutrition in certain countries, but it also has a very high load of calcium. The other thing about milk is that we fortify it with vitamin D and iron. And we, as a community, we tend to not get enough vitamin D and iron, and so milk is one of the most important sources of those for us. Iron is also fortified in your cereals and pastas and grains, so it's another good source of iron, but it's added nature. So there is an added benefit to milk because we put in vitamins and minerals that we really do need for long-term health. That being said, I care most about milk through the growing years. I really care most about milk through the growing years. Once you get to young adulthood, I care about making sure people are drinking water and not high sugar, high calorie drinks, because you're still concerned about obesity and overweight. But the big calcium and protein push in the childhood and teen years is important, because when you look at those kids, anyone who has a teenager knows, it's really hard for them to eat nutritionally balanced meals in general. It's just very, very difficult for them to get it in time-wise, and they have certain tastes, and they want to buy their own food, and they're, you know, so if you can get a glass of milk in them, you're doing well.
Mm-hmm.
In that group.
Okay. Now, going along the lines of milk, you mentioned a lot of different ones. Are there ones that are better for you? In other words, for instance, the coconut milk versus the almond milk, or the soy milk versus the cow's milk. What would be better?
You know, it's different strokes for different folks. There are people who have nut allergies who can't do the nut milks. Their soy milk is a wonderful source of milk, but I believe it really needs to be organic soy milk, because there is so much genetically modified soy in our country that you're getting sort of the added layer of genetic modification, which gets a little complicated, but, you know, just briefly, you'd like to avoid genetically modified foods if you can. So when you drink soy milk, you want to do organic, but it's very variable. Rice milk, very good source of milk, has less protein. Okay, so cow's milk and soy milk are very high protein, rice milk, a little low protein. But again, you know, it really depends upon the family and the child and the nutritional situation. If you've got a vegetarian or a vegan family, they might use one type. If you have, you know, a family that doesn't have any eating restrictions, they might go to another type of milk.
Now, speaking of organic, I think all of us now see that there's a section in our store.
Yes.
You know, depending on what store you go to, you know, there is an organic section. How much better is that? And I've got a whole different thought on it, which is it just seems ridiculous to me that we now pay more for something because to keep them from putting the stuff in it that we don't want them to put in to begin with.
It is incredible, isn't it? You know, when I speak, I always point out that when I was young, you always avoided the organic aisle because everything looked so mealy.
Yeah.
You know, there were a couple of heads of lettuce and a brown apple, and that was your organic section.
Right,
exactly.
And now, obviously, it's so different, you know. But organic, there are strict definitions of what counts as organic, and basically, you're exactly right. It's what's not in it. There's no antibiotics. There is no pesticide. There's no genetic modification. There's no sewage sludge in the soil. I mean, there's a whole list of criteria, and it's more expensive because, as it turns out, in order to raise the animals or the produce in this way, it costs a little bit more. I personally can't really wrap my brain around spending money on organic for 100% of everything I buy, and I don't think most Americans can either. So you got to pick and choose what you buy that's organic. My general rule for patients is to buy naked fruits and vegetables that are organic. So what I mean by that is a lettuce leaf should probably be organic because you're eating the leaf and it's not protected with anything, whereas banana, it's got a big, thick skin on it, and any pesticide spray, anything that's going to be on top of that banana, even though I don't really want it, it's not going to penetrate into the fruit in the way that it will if you're eating the naked leaf. So that's, I think, a good, cheap and easy way of distinguishing should I really buy it or not. Now, there are people out there who vehemently disagree with that rule, and I understand that, but in terms of what's economically reasonable for most people, when you're looking at produce that costs two or three times as much when it's organic, then our kids aren't eating fruits and vegetables. If we have a choice between non-organic or none, I'll take non-organic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that makes sense. I have a question for you regarding like the genetically modified produce. It seems like if you go back to like my parents' age when they were growing up versus, say, my siblings and my children, we're bigger people, taller, stronger, it seems like. And do you think that part of that is because their hormones or the genetically modified type of produce and things that we're eating?
It's a great question, and I don't know.
Okay.
Is it because we have a better variety of foods, fruits, vegetables, proteins, carbohydrates available to us, and we're not malnourished as we might have gone through stages. Certainly our parents and our grandparents might have gone through phases where they didn't have access to the variety of food, or is it what's in our food that might be growing us too big? I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows the answer to that, but certainly, you know, when you look back, folks who grew up in periods like the Great Depression, we know for sure that their nutritional well-being was not the priority. They were just trying to get by and eat and feed themselves. And so I have to guess that some of the difference that we see is just better supply and better availability. Does make me wonder if, you know, children are eating fast food now, are they going to be bigger and taller in 20 or 30 years, or will they be smaller because they're not feeding themselves as nutritiously? And, of course, we don't know the answer to that. It's interesting. We know that when children gain too much weight, when they become overweight or obese, that often that goes hand in hand with being tall. And you might notice that some of the kids who go through puberty a little bit earlier and develop a little bit earlier tend to be the bigger, taller kids. And that has a lot to do with the fact that when you have more fat tissue in your body, that you also have a different hormone level in your body, and that may, in fact, change the rate at which you go through puberty. But does that affect height? Ultimately, we don't know. We have no idea.
Okay.
Well, and along those lines, and I love the fact you said that we don't know, and now I'm going to say I think I do. But and for everybody knows I'm not a doctor, but I think if you look at some of the studies, and one of the studies that I recall had to do with the Samoan population, and at a time in which the U.S. government was providing them with beef that had an extreme amount of hormones in it. And they grew to be a very large a large people, you know. So I think that if we look at some of the places where the U.S. has provided, you know, certain types of foods that we know were altered, I think it does have something to do with it. I think the hormones, especially in the meat products, you know, I think have had a difference. But again, it's just a theory. There is no medical, you know. To back it up.
It's interesting. That's very interesting. We have this mantra in medicine: correlation is not causation. And what that means is, it is very important to note when things track, when something is given to a population and then they have a change in their health or well-being. But it still doesn't prove that that's what caused it. And unfortunately, correlation has caused a lot of confusion. It's at the root of a lot of what confuses parents today about what's safe or dangerous for their kids. They, you know, boy, when I give my child a vaccine when they're a year old and then they have symptoms of autism when they're between 15 and 18 months, it must have been the vaccine. That's correlation.
Right.
But that's not causation. The vaccine hasn't been proven to cause the disease. So it gets very tricky. How much do we rely upon correlation? Of course, we have to look at it. It's very important. But the science of proving takes some time.
Why would you say that autism is on the rise? You may not have the exact answer,
yep.
But
I absolutely don't.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know if there's a guess in the medical profession.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I will tell you, I don't know why. It is a heartbreaking issue that close to 1 in 100 children in this country is diagnosed with autism. Is a huge problem. It's an epidemic, and it's something we need to solve. What I do feel very strongly about, and what the data seems to support very strongly, is that vaccines do not cause autism, but that leaves open any number of things that might. I mean, there are theories that range from flame retardant chemicals being at the cause to other environmental pollutants to today. There was an article that came out I just saw about an hour ago about maternal age, how old the mother is being correlated with autism. Of course, there are studies that show the exact opposite. There are studies that show that it's the father's age that's associated. So I don't think anyone knows. I think it's high time we really start investing some resources in figuring this out. And taking some of the money away from too much focus on vaccines. We have studied vaccines for the past decade, and I think we've pretty much put that one to rest. Let's now start studying what these are, because this is a huge issue. I mean, massive, and mm-hmm. and it's not getting better. The rate of autism diagnoses is increasing, not decreasing.
Now, is it increasing more in our country than it is in underdeveloped countries?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that, but certainly it is developed countries that are on the leading edge of autism services, of autism diagnoses, autism interventions. So I'm going to guess that the answer is yes, but I think it's just as likely that we're looking for it here and that there are underdeveloped countries where they don't have the resources to look for it.
True.
I don't know if we went out and looked for it, what the differences would be.
Right, and that was exactly my thought, because oftentimes it's, you know, it can be happening. They just aren't aware of what to look for, or really aren't diagnosing it. You know, they're putting it putting in another category and moving on. So, but I think that's one of the things that would help us to determine if it has to do with something that are the chemicals that we're putting in our body.
That's right, and I tell you, this is, I mean, it's heartbreaking. And when you talk to families who are dealing with this on a day-to-day basis, they are desperate for answers, and they deserve answers. So we need to start figuring this out. And I don't think there's going to be one answer. I think there's going to be more than one answer, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, having gone through the book, and I noticed that in the book, you point out in the beginning that scientific discoveries happen daily and parents should be attuned to new data. Your book is a great resource for weeding out what is useful and what is overblown. Are there other resources that you suggest parents can turn to, especially if things are happening that quickly?
Absolutely. You know, in the back of my book, I have my top 10 favorite websites for parents who are not doctors, because I think it's incredibly difficult to navigate this information on your own. What I tell people is don't just Google it, because when you put in a search term, you get back, first of all, too much information. Second of all, you can't weed out the valid from the invalid. So, I have my top 10 sites. People are welcome to use them or use any others they like, what they should be looking for is valid information. They need to know who is creating the website, who is posting the information, because you can find a site that's going to tell you just about anything, and it leads to a lot of confusion and concern among parents. So use the internet, but use it cautiously, and ask your physician what couple of sites you should be using for medical information.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you find today that a lot of parents are becoming too cautious about their children in regards to, you know, toxins, pesticides, and drugs, or are we still not really cautious enough?
We are overly cautious, often about the wrong things. So these are all issues that show up on the front page of the LA Times and the front page of the New York Times, and they're all sexy topics, but the things that we need to be more vigilant about are, you know, loaded handguns in the home that are unlocked that children have access to, or we need to be thinking about uncovered, unlocked swimming pools or bodies of water where children can drown. I mean, these are really the issues, the safety issues that haven't changed, frankly, in decades, that parents forget about because they're not as topical and they're not always on the front page of the paper. And I do get concerned that we have focused so much on chemicals and environmental hazards and things we can't see, and we forget about the very real dangers that we can see. You know, when we drive, as we said earlier, put down your phone. That's a bigger risk than a lot of the things that I go through in the book. And it's not to minimize concerns of today's parents, but just to sort of readjust the focus and remind people there are some more important fish to fry in terms of child safety.
Well, and I think one of the things that I've seen in kids and even in myself has to do with allergies. And I've looked into it a little bit, and it seems like we have a huge increase in allergies. What do you think is causing this?
It's enormous, and it's very real. You know, anyone who says, oh, it's just that people are diagnosing it more. No. I mean, 30 years ago, you almost never had a school that said you can't bring nuts. Today, it's very difficult to find a school that allows children to bring nuts in their lunch because there are so many fatally allergic children in a school body at this point. It's a remarkable increase. My personal theory after combing through all the data is that the allergists who are suspicious about genetic modification, and this goes back to our organic discussion, those researchers are onto something. So if you look at soybeans, for instance,
right.
92% of our soy crop in this country is genetically modified, and it's modified so that the soy can grow better and produce more product, and so that perhaps if we have a drought or a freeze or, you know, you have some condition that's not conducive to perfect soy crop, well, you can get through it with a little genetic modification. The problem is that in order to genetically modify foods, you have to use genes from other foods, and nut DNA is used often in genetic modification. So there are some soybeans, for instance, that contain little pieces of peanut DNA. And if you are giving soy to a little baby, you're not thinking about exposing that baby to peanut. The chemists and biologists who are out there know it shouldn't work this way. Genetic modification uses these teeny tiny particles of DNA, and they're really not even complete proteins. They should not affect the body the way that we think they affect the body, but it doesn't matter, should or shouldn't. It seems that genetic modification is associated with allergy in some meaningful way. And again, this is a good example of correlations, not causation. No one's proven it yet, but it tracks very, very clearly. And so, you know, another reason to try to go for organic when you can is to avoid that genetic modification and the exposure to potential allergens.
Okay, I'm going to throw a couple more things out at you, and I'll use the name of the book as my question. Dangerous or safe, plastics in the microwave?
If it says microwave safe on the bottom of the plastic, it has been tested, and it should be safe. However, despite that, I generally tell people you should microwave in ceramic or glass. It just feels a little bit better, or just use stovetop heating and skip the microwave altogether if you want.
Okay. Dangerous or safe? Adult cold and cough medications for children.
In 2007, the FDA said infants could no longer have cough and cold medicines. Under the age of 2, it was unsafe. In 2008, they changed that and they said under the age of 4. There are people who believe it should be under the age of 6. They don't work for kids, so don't use them. But for over the age of about 6, they're safe, they're fine, they're just Band-Aid solutions. You're better off using chicken soup and sleep and all the old-time cures. But if your teenager really needs to get back to school and has a bad runny nose, you know, you can try a little cough and cold medicine occasionally, and it's safe.
What about antibiotics? Do you feel that they're given too freely?
You know, I think maybe 10 or 15 years ago, the answer to that question would have been yes. Doctors have really scaled back on their use of antibiotics, and they have a healthy respect for them. Patients will often beg for them. They will demand mm-hmm. them, and doctors will say, look, you don't have an illness that responds to an antibiotic, and I won't give it inappropriately. So doctors have really made a massive effort to curb their use of antibiotics. But antibiotics on the farm, that's an issue. So cattle and poultry, they are routinely given antibiotics, and that is a big source of exposure for us. And that is another place where consumers really need to start becoming aware. And you know, when you go and you purchase meat or eggs or even produce, you want to make sure it's antibiotic-free.
Okay.
All right. Dangerous or safe? Nail polish being worn by children?
Probably not dangerous. There are phthalates and other chemicals, plasticizers in the nail polish that we are concerned might go into children's bodies and may affect the way their hormones work. Those chemicals tend to be in lotions and shampoos as well. When you watch a 2 or a 3-year-old who has nail polish on, they are constantly picking at their fingers, they're putting their fingers in their mouth, they're actually ingesting the nail polish. So on the nail, probably not an issue. Consumed, well, it's not very well studied, so keep it off your child. Make it a special occasion thing, birthdays, once a year, that kind of thing is fine, but I wouldn't make a routine of putting nail polish on your kids.
All right. We've got just a couple more minutes. One of the things that I'd like to make sure that we touch on is tell people where they can find the book. Is there a particular website? What is the best way for them to find the book and or to get a hold of you if they have questions?
Sure. Well, I have a site called dangerousorsafe.com, and you can get the book, which is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and you know, all the major online booksellers. You can click right through on the site. There's also a little bit more information, that top 10 list of best internet resources for non-doctors is actually up on that website, and you can certainly take a look at it and use it as you like. So that's probably the best starting point online.
All right, and if they have particular questions, you know, if there's something going on with their child, is there a blog or something where they can put those questions out?
You know, there's not a mechanism for that yet, but there will be one coming soon on the site. There are multiple blog pieces that, you know, I've published on Huffington Post and elsewhere that respond to current issues in the media. And, you know, whatever study comes out, most of that is addressed in blogs, but I'm hoping to get the Q&A piece of the site up and running shortly.
All right. And what is the number one piece of advice you hope parents will take away from reading Dangerous or Safe?
Don't panic. Don't listen to what your friends or neighbors say and assume it to be true and panic. Instead, when you hear something is supposed to be dangerous, do a little bit of research on your own. Think about how it's going to affect your family and your life. And if you decide to make a change based upon that information, make small incremental changes. Don't go changing every single thing in your kitchen and in your household because the rest of your family is not going to be on board with you. So small incremental changes only when you feel that they're appropriate and you've gone and you've done your own reading about the newest hyped item.
Well, Cara, thank you very much. We are out of time, but I appreciate you sharing this with us. And again, the book is Dangerous or Safe. If you have any questions, go to that website. Cara, just keep being out there working for us and getting the information we need to keep our kids safe.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right.
Thank
Take
you
care.
So much.
All right. Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.